It is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. Now, the first song that we've got for you this week is Bomb the Bass and Beat This from 1987. Now, DJ Simon Simonon, DJ Tim Simonon, a.k.a. Bomb the Bass, broke out of the London clubs with a house 12-inch that was heavy on samples, very hard on the beats and hard-edged in its attitude. Beat This, with its samples from Public Enemy, Ennio Morricone and the Thunderbirds, is one of the defining tracks in house music. Most house music had come out of the U.S., into the underground of clubs in the UK, but Simonon and some of his colleagues had a uniquely British style of house that was to develop over the next decade. Beat This eventually crossed over into the mainstream charts and out into the suburbs. Simonon's gift was to translate the excitement of a live DJ and his feels for the listener onto a track that worked outside the club as well as in. The club culture and the arrival of ecstasy made house and acid house the dominant styles in British pop culture as the late 1980s, with the combination of hip-hop attitude and swing of rock and roll energy. Simonon went on to produce more records than he cut, working notably with Michael Hutchence and Nair Nair Cherry. Beat This will transport you back to the speedy hot nights of 1987. Wherever it is. Oh, joy, I can't find it. Here we are.
...have been changed to protect the innocent.
Yeah.
Bomb the bass and beat this. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. Now, this book, 1001 Songs, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as I mentioned before, actually. This is written by the great Australian music journalist, editor of the Rolling Stone in the 1980s. He wrote this book. He wasn't saying the 1001 songs of all time. He was saying, what was he saying? That's right, he was saying the most influential songs over the past 100 years, approximately, in my opinion. Which is a bit tepid and tentative. I do love those two words, tepid and tentative, but I don't... But that's why he wrote it. But in the end, he called it 1001 Songs because he thought that would sell better, I suppose. The next most influential song, in his opinion, is Arcadian Driftwood by The Band. After a brilliant start with two albums, The Band buckled under the weight of their own reputation and, of course, drugs and money. Ill feeling in the group started when other players felt that Robbie Robertson was getting an unfair share of the credit and the revenue. Northern Lights was to be their last album, not counting the contractual obligation of Islands of New Material. It has two real gems, It Makes No Difference and Arcadian Driftwood. Another historical epic that bookends the night they drove old Dixie down. Arcadian Driftwood is the story of a group of Canadians who fled the British and moved south, settling in Louisiana, where they became known as Cajun. It is a story that roughly follows Robertson's own biography and certainly fits his affinity for the music of New Orleans. After the war between Montcalm and Wolfe in 1759, Robinson explained there was a question as to whether Canada was going to belong to France or Britain. After Britain finally won, it was put up to the people living there whether they had to swear their allegiance to Britain or give up their land. So some of them went to the old country, some of them went to the French Islands, the Caribbean, and some went across the border down the Mississippi to Louisiana. And this took place over some 3 years, and what happened out of this was the birth of the Cajun population. I've always found it a fascinating story, and anyone I've ever spoken about it said, "No kidding, I didn't know that." It's kind of an untold story. I was overwhelmed when I found out how very few people knew where the Cajuns came from. With fiddler for accompaniment, Brian Berline, and accordion from Garth Hudson, it was the ideal swan song for the band. This is The Band and Arcadian Driftwood.
Smoking as the men with some speed on to finish what they started. They never parted, they're just built that way.
Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. That was the band, and Arcadian Driftwood. Now, What have we got next for you? We've got REM and Losing My Religion here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4. And don't forget, we've got our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz, which you can get live streaming from there. And, of course, our Facebook page, facebook.com/Waiheke Radio. Well, I think it's one word. I'll just type it in. No, I won't type it in and see, because that would be very, very distracting and everything. And so, yes, well, you know. But this is REM and Losing My Religion from 1991, and this was the song that would make REM household names in 1991. Stripes' beautiful, yearning voice sings about indecision and regret and fear in an abstract lyric that sits atop their most beguiling tune. The melody was written by Peter Buck in 1990, shortly after he bought his first mandolin, an instrument he barely uses other than for the song. The group thought that the song would keep them out of the charts and mainstream and maintain their cult status. There's no chorus, it's 5 minutes long, there's no guitar. It's a fucking mandolin song, where's the pop song in that? Asked Stripe. He doesn't talk like that, does he? Musically, it's very straightforward. I don't think the bass player, Mike Mills, talks like that either. There is something satisfying about the song in the sense that in the way... I'm going to ditch this lisp. In the sense that in the way the sound of the mandolin combines with the chords, it's appealing, evocative nature of the lyrics, and a fabulous video. And you put that together, and it's a kind of fluke, but thank goodness, I'm not even sure if that song could be a single now, but it came out at the right time, and at the right place. That's REM, and Losing My Religion.
Just
R.E.M. and Losing My Religion here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. As selected by Toby Criswell and presented by yours truly, Seth Tetley Jones, next up on this list of 1001 Songs, there's about 144th on the list, more or less, though it doesn't actually number them, but it's about that. Jackie Wilson and Lonely Teardrops from 1959. Jack Leroy Wilson was initially a boxer before he and, like his local buddies, Levi Stubbs, Hank Ballard, and Little Willie John, took up singing. He was profoundly influenced by Al Jolson, a Jewish man who sang in blackface. Wilson sang gospel and pop and came to the attention of Billy Ward, the leader of the first popular R&B group in the Dominoes. In 1953, this song was from 1959, Wilson replaced the lead singer, Clyde McFesser, in the Dominoes, and by 1956 he had made his own name. Elvis Presley was heard to praise him and gone out on his own. Wilson's friends from Detroit were an important part of his success, notably the songwriting team of his cousin Raquel Davis, a.k.a. Tyron Carlo, and Berry Gordy Jr., who later started Motown Records. In 1959, Wilson cut their epic Lonely Teardrops. The song's spare backing allowed Wilson's voice the space to perform its magic. Lonely Teardrops was a seminal soul single that was profoundly influential vocal from Wilson. In 1975, while singing a song at his casino in New Jersey, Wilson suffered a heart attack that put him in a coma and left him paralyzed until his death in 1984. Very sad, but many years before that, he recorded Lonely Teardrops.
Save it!
Jackie Wilson and Lonely Teardrops from 1959. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM. 1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Creswell, and something like that. You probably could tell I could, you know, hold the mic out to all of you people listening in your homes if I felt so inclined as to run around to all your homes. In fact, if I knew where all your homes were, which admittedly I don't, because that's just one of the things that this computer up here doesn't tell us is who's listening. But if you are listening, then good on you. Keep up the good work. It's Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4, and www.waihekeradio.com for live streaming. Nirvana and Heart-Shaped Box from 1993, from the album In Utero. Courtney Love gave her husband a heart-shaped box. Then followed Tempestuous Romance. Tempestuous. Oh, he is good with his words. Romance of Drugs and Fame and Power and Children, all conducted under the perpetual gaze of the tabloid media. Cobain was a star and Courtney wanted to be. There's no doubt that he loved her and that she gave him something he needed. But it's also clear that he regarded the volatile relationship as a codependency after police were called to his house following a particularly loud argument. Cobain was accused of choking his wife. But both parties denied this. "Sure, Courtney and I fight. We argue a lot," he told John Savage. "But I've never choked my wife. It's an awful fucking thing to be printed, to be thought of you. You know, when we haven't had any problems, any bad reports, any negative articles written about us in a long time, we thought we were finally over it. And then that's a curse we had worn itself out." Then, when Savage suggested that people have perceived you as a threat, Cobain replied, "I think that Courtney's more of a threat than I am." As usual, Cobain hedges his bets. Perhaps he never really knew himself. The arrival of his daughter, Frances Bean, complicated matters further. Oh, actually, I read something about that. He said it's called Frances. She's called Frances Bean because he looked at the ultrasound and said she looks like a bean. And so he very cleverly thought that that might make a good middle name for her. There's a feeling that of entrapment in Heart-Shaped Box. Cobain was needed, indeed trapped at the time by his addiction, his fame, his desire for fame, and his mariage. It's surprising that he made such a pretty good song out of it all. This is no, it isn't. It's Nirvana and Heart-Shaped Box is what it is.
Oh,
Nirvana and Heart-Shaped Box from the 1993 album In Utero. You're listening to YHU Radio. Though I didn't actually mean that to rhyme, but it just came out that way, you know? You know how something, sometimes you just say just random things and they end up rhyming? Yes, it is rather awkward sometimes, occasionally, sometimes, but we all survive. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell, the Australian music journalist, and presented by yours truly, Seth Tetley-Jones. The next song, which Toby Cresswell has diligently selected for us and your listening pleasure today, is MC5. And Kick Out the Jams. Kick Out the Jams was an absolute pinnacle of high-energy rock and roll. The Detroit-based MC5 slammed their way through their first album. Very few groups start out with a live album, but MC5 were totally correct here. They had done a few lame studio singles for independent labels, but when signed to Elektra, they intended to blow the lid off the music business. MC5 stands for Motor City 5. They were managed by John Clinsair, a local Detroit activist who formed the White Panther Party to get in on some of the revolutionary action that the Black Panthers were stirring up. He declared MC5 the cultural arm of the White Panther Party. Not only did they bankroll the White Panthers, but they also gave a national spotlight to a local revolution. But then it would be hard for young men to resist the revolutionary front whose manifesto was dope, guns, and fucking in the streets. The phones were always tapped. You could hear them clicking and popping in there. The police would come by our house and run the siren at night when we were sleeping and flash their spotlights on the windows, said guitarist Wayne Kramer, recalled. And any time we stamped out, we were subject to search and the vans were always pulled over. The police would come up on stage and tell us we couldn't play that song, and it was really out of control. And that was only the tip of the iceberg. And we found out later that that there was a plan in place coming from the highest offenses of power to highest offices of power to destroy us. And the main venue in Detroit in 1968 was the Grand Ballroom, and this is where the MC5 took the stand for their first album. The energy in the Grand Ballroom was everywhere in the air, bouncing off and around the walls. The guitars of Wayne Kramer and Sonic Smith crunched against each other in wild squalls of electric noise while the bass and drums pounded out a Motown meets metal beat. But all that the White Panther rhetoric had been lost in the winds of history. There was not a lot of hype on the group. We're trying to emulate free jazz, and they're nowhere near that. What we have here is absolute high-energy rock and roll. I think he's already said that. Maybe he's... Well, I suppose I say the same thing every 25 times a sentence, even when I'm not reading stuff out, so I can't complain, can I? Which has seldom been matched and never been bettered.
We are struggling how to learn our instruments and play the songs and be able to perform to people, Wayne Kramer told The Perfect Sound Forever. We gravitated to a certain kind of material, like the music of Chuck Berry and instrumental records of the certain that had a what we'd call high energy. There's that high energy word again. I told you. We later became articulate enough to define it as music, and that was really visceral. It was about a lot of hate and energy, and like the music of James Brown, black gospel music. Their favor was aided by the fact that they were on a comic mission. Cosmic mission. I was thinking to myself. Pure sound energizes. The more energy of the sound, the bigger that the sound gets, it gets to you, and the more intense the experience is. And the more intense reality is. The your metabolic reality that at that moment, you know, is an intensive feeling in your metabolism. And that's where you find your reality. And music is equated on that level, too, because it doesn't make very metabolic changes. Like on the stage, I notice metabolic changes at every instant. So fast, your heartbeat and your respiration and everything. And because you're using your body 100%. And that's what music is supposed to make you do. It's supposed to make you use your body 100% so that you can force yourself and put in as much energy as possible and make a perfect circuit so that there's a high energy flow between the music and the audience. It all becomes one big thing and reinforces itself, and everybody feels pure and clean. We send it out, and they send it back to you, and we send it out harder, and it culminates in reaction, and things happen in that room. It's necessary. It's the killer experience and the purge, purification, and the resensification on all levels. Resensify your back to your meat, because that's the way you take it in. Your meat is your senses, and because your senses are made out of meat. And if you don't keep the contact with your meat, then they're only straight people. They're so fucked up, man, because they're meatloaf. They're just rots. It rots. Kick Out the Jams, by contrast, is fresh as the day it was performed. MC5 played with reckless abandon, and I think it was probably the first band that did that. We were always reaching into the unknown, and I think that's it. No one else played that way before, and that's what hardcore punk was all about, playing there with reckless abandon, with no regard for the safe things that you know about. And that's it. We were bad. And they were bad, and this is MC5, and Kick Out the Jams.
That was MC5 and Kick Out the Jams there from 1969, I was right. Just thought I could try and remember it. You know, that might make a good stunt, but then I realised that you couldn't really tell whether I remembered it or whether I was reading it, so that put paid to that. And what did they say? What did they say on those old comic books? They say, that's torn it. Oh, that's torn it. That did tear it, yes. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM. Also on www.waihekeradio.org.nz for live streaming, or facebook.com/waihekeradio/... Oh, I still haven't looked that up. And I've been sitting here on Facebook the entire time, aren't I, Slack? Yeah. Yes. Eels and Never Came for the Souls from 1996. Eels frontman Mark Oliver Everett, who goes by the name of E, was perfectly placed for the era of compliant rock in the mid-90s. He was troubled. He was alienated. He also was talented, and his songs transcended self-pity. It would be unfair to lumber him in with most of these songs of now-forgotten whinges. Novocaine for the Soul has a beguiling new folk arrangement and a production help from Michael Simpson. Does it say Stimpson or something? No, it says Simpson. Yeah. One Half of the Dust Brothers. It's a beautiful song of alienation and sorrow that is also uplifting. The strings and the gentle backing recall classic Los Angeles productions by Lenny Ronka. I always was aware of this immense sense of loneliness that I now recognize as being a fish out of water, he said of his life as a teenager growing up in Virginia before he moved in Los Angeles. The upbringing was what I thought of as a typical suburban, but of course there is no typical. It was lonely. I didn't get what I needed as a child emotionally, and that created a lot of problems for me. But I've been working hard as an adult to even things out for a long time. Music has saved me, and it's been my way to deal with it. Someone that's wallowing in sadness has given up and doesn't write in these songs, said E. The act of writing these songs is helpful. There is a life-affirming quality in the music. There's almost a positive punchline, and it does have a certain something in common with angst rock, but then it departs from it at a certain point. I'm surprised that people have noticed that it's different. This is Eels and Novocaine for the Soul.
Little bird, with your beak pressed against the window, there are no seeds for you today. Life is hard, and so am I. Better give me something so I don't die. Novocaine for the soul. Before I sputter out. Before I sputter out. Life is white and I am black. Jesus and his lawyer coming back. Oh, my darling, will you be here before I sputter out? Before I sputter out. Before I sputter. Who's living here with the great undead? This paint by numbers life is fucking with my head once again. ¶¶ I was a great mistake. Novocaine for the soul. You better give me something to fill the hole. Before I sputter out.
That was The Eels and Novocaine for the Soul. You're listening to Waiheke Radio on 88.3 and 107.4 FM, and this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as presented by Seth Daly Jones and selected by Debbie Crystal. Oh my god, I said that all in one breath. That's about the second time in my life that I've actually done that. Or maybe the third or fourth or fifth time, but anyway, it's probably a one-digit number. The next is Little Ava and the Locomotion from 1962. The tale behind this song is a true Cinderella story. Ava Narcissus Boyd came up from Belhaven, North Carolina, to New York, where she babysat the two daughters of Jerry Coffin and Carol King. By day, the husband and wife team worked for Don Krishna's Eldon Music, where they had an office at 1650 Broadway. She describes an annex to the Brill Building. So we were part of that thing that involved Don Krishna saying, so-and-so is up and needs a follow-up. And all the writers would go into their cubicles and work away. King told Barry Miles, describing the Bill Building scene, we would simply just go home because we happened to be married, but it was the same idea. You would come in the next day, and everyone would play their song, and hoping that they would be the one to get the follow-up, knowing that the others were also doing the same thing. Goffin and King came with a dance-crazed song, The Locomotion, and used their babysitter to do a guide vocal on the demo. Krishna liked it, so he put the demo out as the first release of his Dimension label, and the first Jerry Goffin production, and the song shot to number one. It was a big hit for Grand Funk Railroads in the 1970s, and for Kylie Minogue in the 80s. According to Carole King, there never really was a dance called The Locomotion until after it was a hit. Everyone says, how's this dance go? So Little Ava had to make up a dance. What a nice legacy for Little Ava there. On The Locomotion. We'll be right back. Little Ava there and The Locomotion. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, Wayno 7.4 and 88.3, and this is 1001 Songs. Our final track for this evening is AC/DC, and it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll from 1975. This was Bon Scott's life story. He had been a singer with pop group The Valentines in the 60s, topping the Australian charts. Then a member of bluesy progressive rock collective Fraternity on the hippie trail in London. Bon had tasted success and failure, mostly the latter. When he joined AC/DC, they were punk kids playing a circuit of suburban dances, high schools, rough pubs, and the like for no money and less glory. Although the group were related to Australian rock royalty, Angus and Malcolm were brothers of George Young, member of the Easy Beats, their early years were a tough grind of loud music, abuse, and poverty. As Scott wrote to his wife around this time, I just want to be famous, I guess. So when people talk about you, it's good things that I say. Now, things changed in 1975 when the group began recording and having some radio play. Quite clearly, the Young Brothers had unique chemistry as guitar players, and through months of solid touring, had developed their own style, with the first album getting more serious attention. Perhaps Scott felt there was some hope. Produced by Harry Vander and George Young, Long Way was recorded at Albert's studio in King Street, Sydney. It was very small, said bass player Dave Evans. We used to record in the side room, and we had two Marshall stacks and a bass rig pointing towards the wall and mic'd up. And it used to be in the kitchen, drums in there, and everything put down at once. Generally, the fire was in the first couple of takes. It's a long way to the top, had the addition of Bon Scott playing the bagpipe solo, one of the first, well, the first one on a rock and roll record. The track captures a particular battler spirit that reflects Australian roots of the song and is one of the reasons why it has become an iconic number in Australia. When they wrote the song, AC/DC could have no idea how close to the top they would get. It's unfortunate that Scott wasn't with them when it happened. AC/DC, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. AC/DC, and it's a long way to the top if you wanna rock and roll. This has been 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. I'm Seth Titley Jones, and these songs were selected by Toby Cresswell, the Australian music journalist. You can catch my repeat of this show on Sunday. No, not Sunday, Saturday, I think. Yes, Saturday at 2 in the afternoon. Or I will be back, alternatively, I will be back next week at 8 p.m. in the evening. Actually, there is no 8 p.m. in the morning, isn't it? God, I'm smart sometimes. There is no 8 p.m. in the morning, but I will definitely be here at 8 p.m. in the evening next Monday for my next week's show.